Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on Conspiracy Theory Thursday, live on the Radio Northwest Network and supplying honestly provocative talk for the Pacific Northwest. I thought I'd start with Kate Brown, and I have a warning for you. You are likely to see on television and read online and in your newspaper, even in some of the national publications, Kate Brown, the governor of Oregon, is getting a tremendous amount of attention for something she said yesterday. Now, I think she should get the attention because she came out and publicly announced that she would defy the president of the United States in a way that she does not have one single shred of authority to do. Understand what I'm saying? You know that I've said critical things about Jay Inslee of Washington. I've said critical things about Kate Brown. An awful lot of the Democrats do crazy things, and I take issue with them. But I usually don't say, and they don't have the legal authority to do what they say they're going to do. This one, though, is a lot simpler because it involves the National Guard. There are National Guard units present in every state in America. And when they are at the state level, they can be used by the governor. A governor can decide to deploy the National Guard in, say, Mississippi to put sandbags up when it's flooding. A National Guard can be used in, say, Washington State to go off and fight wildfires at the direction of the governor. The governors control the National Guard until one thing happens. That one thing is when they are federalized and called to service by the President of the United States, the Commander-in-Chief of our military. At that moment, when the President federalizes them, they are no longer under the control of the governor. Now, the word about this came down by tweet from Kate Brown, governor of Oregon, late yesterday, and I just mentioned it toward the end of the program because literally the tweet had come down 5 minutes before I mentioned it on the air. And my first reaction was, she doesn't have the power to do that. And I thought, well, I'm going to do my due diligence. So we reached out to the National Guard. And we said, we'd like somebody to come on. We know you can't talk about politics and you aren't likely to want to talk about what the governor is saying politically because she's in a reelection bid. So people who are running for reelection often say crazy things. But while I understand you can't comment on the governor and politics and all that, what you can do is make it clear something that is not being made clear in most of the reporting on this, on television, on the internet, etc., is that she doesn't have the power to do it. And let me tell you exactly what she's saying so you'll know that I'm not exaggerating this. From TheHill.com. TheHill.com is one of the two major online entities that cover Capitol Hill in Washington, D.C. What does the headline say? Oregon governor, I'll say no if Trump asks me to deploy National Guard troops to the Mexico border. And the story begins. Oregon Governor Kate Brown said she would reject a request from President Trump to dispatch National Guard troops to the U.S.-Mexico border if, and she did this as a tweet, if at real Donald Trump asked me to deploy Oregon Guard troops to the Mexico border, I'll say no. But she didn't stop there. She went on to say, quote, as commander of Oregon's Guard, I'm deeply troubled by Trump's plan to militarize our border. She also added, there's been no outreach by the president or federal officials. Apparently, Kate Brown seems to think that as a liberal Democrat from a left-wing state, that Donald Trump's going to have her on speed dial. There's been no outreach, and I have no intention of allowing Oregon's Guard troops to be used to distract from his troubles in Washington, D.C. Well, there's a little problem with that. As I explained, the basics are, National Guard, when not federalized, entirely under the control of the governor of that state, whatever state they happen to be in. When they're federalized, they are under the control of the president of the United States, and the governor doesn't have a darn thing to say about it. Now, as I said, I did my due diligence, reached out to the National Guard. My producer, Carl Sundberg, reached out to the National Guard and said, we'd like to have somebody come on and talk about this. They have sent us back a statement, and all the statement says is, we haven't been asked yet. Now, at this point, they have not responded to our request for an interview. And I have a feeling they're probably dodging a political bullet. They do not want to come on and say, the governor is saying things that she doesn't have the authority to do. But what frustrates me is that there are an awful lot of people out there who aren't pointing this out. I looked at some of the television news last night. They did not point this out. They all just said, hey, Governor Brown is going to show her resistance. I also looked at OregonLive.com, which is the online website for the dead tree operation known as the Oregonian, where they publish news on dead trees. And they have a story, a long story, that talks about how Kate Brown is going to keep up the resistance against Donald Trump. She is going to forbid Oregon Guard troops to be assigned to the border. And then way buried down at the bottom, it mentions, essentially, oh, she doesn't have the power to do that, which I think should have gone to the headline. I'd have written the story. Oregon Governor Kate Brown vows to do something she has no authority whatsoever to do. But that's not the way that most folks are writing it. So Kate Brown gets a lot of big national press. And by the way, I called the governor's office this morning and left a message. We've been calling them, you know, really all the way back through Kitzhaber. The Oregon governors, Democrats at least, will not come on and answer questions like, why are you claiming that you have the authority to deny National Guard troops to the president when he has the absolute authority to call them up? Well, so I'm going to ask you in the Twitter poll today, should the governor have threatened to withhold National Guard troops from the border? As I said, that question comes with a caveat. She doesn't have the authority to do it. She's doing this in a re-election year. And I think what it suggests about Kate Brown, she doesn't know what her job is. She doesn't understand what her authority is. Now, would you choose to reelect somebody who doesn't have the first clue about something as important as the military that a governor controls? I wouldn't vote for her, and I don't think anybody else should vote for her either. She apparently is clueless in that job. Anyway, it's Conspiracy Theory Thursday. Your calls are welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com. You can vote in the Twitter poll at Lars Larson Show on Twitter or find it online at LarsLarson.com. When you find it online, check out the challenge coins we have at LarsLarson.com. First, we always start with some nonsense.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
50 years ago, we flocked to see a now classic movie about astronauts doomed by a crazy computer that decided to kill them. Americans met HAL 9000, a murderous pile of integrated circuits.
This mission is too important for me to allow you to jeopardize it.
But that's just science fiction, right? Not quite. Today, a computer decides which accused criminals get out of the Multnomah County Jail. Lately, it's been telling deputies to let killers and rapists go. Katie Shepard at Willamette Week broke the story. And get this, the rocket scientists on the county commission have ordered the sheriff to follow the computer's orders. Of course, the computer wouldn't be cutting killers loose if the county commission hadn't closed jail dormitories last year, forcing the release of more than 150 criminals. No word yet whether Multnomah County's local version of HAL 9000 has filed against Sheriff Mike Reese in the next election. Reese is on vacation, and a chip from Intel is running the show.
This sort of thing has cropped up before, and it has always been due to human error.
That's the Rose City Wrap. I'm Lars Larson. And now today's Daily Girl.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, granite, topsoil, or sand. Let Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks put it where you want it.
Well, for all the reasons I've already mentioned today, I'm going to award today's Daily Grill to Governor Katie Brown, who, for trying to say she has the power to shut down the president's use of the National Guard when she has no such power. And I'd also add to that, all of the people who are likely to cover the story today at your local TV stations and publications online, they should all be asking Kate Brown, do you have the authority? And if she does not, then you have an even bigger story. You have the story of a governor who claims to have authority she does not have and apparently doesn't even know she doesn't have. And to me, that's one heck of a big story. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com. Daniel White writes in, Lars, I have a couple of friends down in Texas that are part of the Border Patrol. I asked them about the president's idea of having the National Guard go down and patrol the border. They were extremely happy about that. They say it's extremely dangerous for them. They never know what they're going to run into. With the guard helping, they won't feel so overwhelmed and on the edge. Signed, Daniel White. Glad to get your emails from all over the Pacific Northwest. That's talk at LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to Conspiracy Theory Thursday on the Lars Larson Show.
Calling all cars.
There's a long line of cars and they're trying to get...
This is the War on the Car.
You might want to buckle up.
On the Lars Larson Show.
That's right, it is. We talk about this from time to time. And then I'm reading the Seattle Times editorial page and I see a piece by an architect, a man who's actually in the business by the name of Marty Kaplan. And Marty Kaplan joins me now. He's an architect. He's also on the land use board. And he's talking about the fact that Seattle, like a lot of cities here, especially here in the liberal Northwest, are pushing policies where they say, we want you to build housing, but don't build any parking with it or build a very small amount of parking on it. You've told me I can call you Marty. So, Marty, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
You said that this is a set of policies not just being done in Seattle, but in many big American cities.
Well, I tend to think that Seattle might be even leading the way, and that we've got significantly more problems, which are good problems, and that the economy is booming here. We've got lots of people moving here and lots of building going on here. So it's a little unique when compared to most cities in the United States. But with it comes a whole lot of challenges that, frankly, I and many others believe that were never really planned for, and we're way behind the gun.
Well, and in fact, you've suggested that it is problematic to build housing without building some parking to go with it, because at least my experience has been when they build a housing project and say, but we're going to aim this at people who only commute by transit or they get there by bicycle or on foot, that doesn't happen. People rent those apartment units or housing units, and then they park their cars in the neighborhood, which creates a whole new problem for everyone who already lives there. Am I off base on that?
No, you're not off base at all, Lars. I mean, it's exactly what's been going on for, well, probably started a decade ago, but certainly ramped up in the last 5 years, where, you know, even these apartment projects, they're marketed as projects that cater to, you know, supply units that are 300 square feet. And the city council wants you to believe that none of those people have cars. And the studies that have been done show about 50% of those people have cars. And therefore, the other 50% of the cars, you know, go into the neighborhoods, and the developers don't have to build parking, so they build cheaper buildings. But unfortunately, the council, especially on Monday, suggested that if developers can build cheaper buildings, then all the rents are magically going to come down. And it's just absolutely false.
You've suggested that is one of the memes that a lot of the folks who like these policies have pushed out, that if we can eliminate parking and cars and all the things that go with them from an apartment building, that the apartment units or the condos or the housing can be cheaper. But you're saying it doesn't actually go that way.
No, of course not. I mean, it doesn't take an economist to understand that what controls the rent of a unit is what the guy next door is going to charge. The market forces are what really, you know, control the market. And right now, you know, rents are sky high in Seattle. And frankly, it doesn't matter if you build a parking garage in your building or not, you're going to charge the same rent for that particular unit. And no matter what. So this idea that you can, you know, if you eliminate all the parking out of a building, therefore the rents will come down, you know, significantly and solve our affordability crisis as if it was magic. It's just absolutely not true. There's no metrics, there's no data, there's no study that suggests so. You know, there's really just ideology that many in, you know, City Hall have just been, preaching for some time. And it's just, you know, it's just absolutely not true. And this whole idea of unbundling, which the bill on Monday suggested, well, if we unbundle the requirement to build parking, then all of a sudden it's going to open up all kinds of new opportunities. Well, frankly, Lars, that unbundling started happening 20 or 30 years ago.
What does unbundling mean, Marty?
Well, it used to be, say, 20 years ago, you built an apartment project and you had to build 1.1 spaces per unit. And those spaces went with a unit. So if you're going to rent a unit for $1,500 a month and it came with a parking spot, that's what you paid. And probably 20 years ago, developers started figuring out that they unbundled that parking space from that apartment. So they still charged X amount of rent for the parking space, but or for the unit. But then they came back and they charged you extra if you wanted a parking space. And most people, if not everyone, renting apartments in the city of Seattle and probably most every other city in the United States would agree that if they wanted a parking space, it didn't come with a unit. You had to pay for it, and developers then were able to create, you know, another revenue source from the parking, which is expensive to build.
Mm-hmm.
So whether or not the building has parking or not, the rental of that particular apartment is going to be the same no matter what. And it's not going to be affected one way or the other by how much it costs the developer to build the building. The developer is still going to maximize his profit and rent that unit out based on market forces, which have zero to do with the money that he's putting into building the building, whether you know, provides parking or not.
The last issue is you said that the city is effectively cheating on its rules. They say you can build these housing units without parking if there's frequent transit, and then they fudge on the numbers to show that there's frequent transit available when, in fact, there isn't.
That's another big problem. I mean, they redefine frequent transit. So what's been happening is that those of us that design buildings, the zoning code is very definite about what the code allows, what it doesn't allow. And in the last 5 years or so, City Hall has said, well, you know, if you are building a multifamily building in an area that has frequent transit, you can reduce your parking count,
yeah,
or eliminate it in some cases. And if a bus comes every 15 minutes, and that's kind of has been the measure for frequent transit, well, there are so many neighborhoods, and there's been a number of challenges to the city.
Marty, let me ask you to hold that thought for just a second. We'll be back in a moment. I'm talking to Seattle architect Marty Kaplan about how the cities are gaming some of these rules. We'll be back, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to have you with me on the Radio Northwest Network. We supply honestly provocative talk radio for the entire Pacific Northwest. And I thought I'd get Marty Kaplan on, who's a longtime architect, also on the local land use boards in Seattle, or on one of the boards. And in fact, I should ask you about that. But as we hit the break, and I apologize for that, Marty, but you were saying that the city games the system because they say you can go out and build or propose to build housing, condos, apartments, whatever. But if there's frequent transit available in the neighborhood, then maybe you don't have to build any parking at all, or you can substantially reduce the amount of parking. How do they end up gaming that system?
Well, Lars, I'm not suggesting that they game the system, but the rules allow developers to push the envelopes. And what they claim is that they're building a building within a zone of frequent transit, and therefore they can cut their parking down or really not even provide any in some cases, depends on where it is.
Mm-hmm.
This measure has always been about, you know, a bus coming about every 15 minutes. And if it's 15 minutes or less, it's in a frequent transit service area. And if it's more, it's not supposed to be classified as a frequent transit area. So over the last few years, especially since the city has exploded with developments and parking has become a huge issue, neighborhoods have appealed these decisions and proven that the frequent transit zones and service areas that these guys are building in, the buses take 30 minutes. And they have prevailed and proved that these zones need to be changed. Either that or we need to get better transit service. Well, the city on Monday decided just simply to move the goalpost and say, well, let's just redefine frequent transit so that developers won't be held to such a tight standard. And such a tight standard, it means that buses may come every 30 minutes. And the city now is going to call that frequent transit, which is absurd. You know, it's like I said in my op-ed, it's like all of a sudden a D becoming a passing grade.
Which, by the way, you point out that's exactly what the school district did not long ago when they said we don't have enough kids passing, and passing is defined as a C, so we'll just expand the definition of passing to a D, and all of a sudden, voila, more kids are passing, and you can report that to the public. It's a PR move, right?
Right, exactly.
So yep. when you bring up these objections to other people who serve on the board that you serve on, that helps make these decisions, what's their reaction to that?
Well, there's a number of different boards, and I was on the Seattle Planning Commission between 2004 and 2012. We talked about all kinds of issues regarding housing and land use planning and many different things, and offered opinions to the mayor and city council. And much of what I'm talking about now has transpired since I got off the Planning Commission. But in those days, I do have to say that there was a city council and a mayor's office and that was really interested in kind of fact-based best practices, study of other cities, you know, what's the best thing that we can do.
Right.
And I have to say, since 2012, when I got off, all I can see is that there's been this trend towards City Hall really not being interested in what anybody in the neighborhoods has to say, or really anybody else. And it's an ideological driven, policy shop down there that says, well, we don't want anybody to drive cars, so therefore there are no cars, so therefore we're just going to take all the parking away. And many council members, and a number in particular, have said numerous times that if we make it impossible for people to park, then people will get out of their cars and take transit. And as any reasonable human being knows, and I'm a native of Seattle, if you make it impossible for people to park, they're not going to go get rid of their car. They're going to move. And this whole idea that you can force people to take transit if they can't find a place to park is not only so disrespectful, and that conversation has never been brought out to the city of Seattle and the neighborhood, the hundreds of thousands of people that deserve to be asked and to be consulted. This is just policymaking at City Hall without asking anybody and with no proof. And that's, unfortunately, that's there's a number of policy initiatives that have come through in the last 3 or 4 years that are founded on this particular type of ideology.
By the way, I'm talking to Marty Kaplan, who's an architect in Seattle and former member of the Land Use Planning Board. I might point this out because if people are listening to this, they might think, well, Marty's just one of Lars's fellow conservative friends. We don't know each other personally, and you were nice enough to give me some time. But I also suspect, having read the piece you wrote, that you and I might be ideologically a bit different on a whole bunch of things, right?
Well, I suspect so.
Yeah.
But, I'm feeling like a lot of others in the city of Seattle, being, a moderate left of center, that now, people that have ideas and progressive ideas, they just aren't liberal enough anymore.
No, it sounds like it. Well, in fact, I mean, we're seeing that all over the country where, there are people who aren't far enough to the left to satisfy some congressional races. But the concern I've got is a centrally planned economy. We watched one of those in the old Soviet Union, and it doesn't work. And when the folks at City Hall say, well, we're going to impose this policy, whether it's Portland City Hall, which is doing some of the same stuff as I told you, or the Seattle City Hall or Spokane or Eugene or wherever, that when they do that and they say, oh, we don't have to care how this actually affects people because we're sitting here in our ivory tower deciding this is how the city will be better off from 30,000 feet. To those people who are down on the ground level getting hit by this, where their entire neighborhood is full of parked cars and they can't even get to their house or apartment. They have to park six blocks away in what is the largely inclement weather of the Pacific Northwest, that you should have a city that treats people like clients, like customers, like you have to treat your customers. I mean, I would imagine that when somebody comes to you for a building design, they don't say, Marty, this is what I'd like. And you say, no, I'm going to tell you what you're going to get, and you're going to be happy with it. That isn't the way you work, is it?
Yeah, no, not at all. So, you're right.
So what do we do to counter this?
Well, what's happening in Seattle, unfortunately, is there's a lot of energy created in the neighborhoods. There's about 300,000 people that live in single-family neighborhoods, and there's a mission downtown to basically get rid of all single-family zoning and convert every single-family neighborhood to multifamily. They're not asking anybody, and so even a couple of years ago, I sued the city because they wanted to convert basically most every piece of property to single-family. Are to multifamily, without any proof, study, or anything. And so, fortunately, we prevailed. And now they are doing the study to try and prove that there are no environmental impacts from rezoning every piece of property in the city of Seattle from, or single-family neighborhoods anyway, to rezone them to multifamily. And so you've got this crazy-making going on. The city council has been challenged like three times in the last few months about policies that they've initiated, and they've been overturned by the court and said it's not legal to do that. And so, unfortunately, those of us that are paying attention, which are a lot of Seattleites, we're forced to appeal some of these decisions. And, you know, right now there's a group with the name of Scale, S-C-A-L-E, that is representing over 27 neighborhoods that are suing the city of Seattle to appeal legislation that allows buildings to be higher and to taller, and as the city claims, it'll provide 6,000 affordable units. But it won't, and there's no studies that prove that it will. So it's incumbent now upon citizens to, you know, keep their government accountable by having to file suits and spend the money and the time to challenge City Hall, where it used to be that City Hall would come and ask first and discuss these changes that they're thinking about with hundreds of thousands of people and show a little bit of respect. But all of a sudden now, when we vote for city council and mayor or anybody else at City Hall, we're voting for dictatorships, apparently, because they're not listening to anybody.
Marty, it's a pleasure to have you on. Thanks for writing that piece, and thanks for being so quick about being willing to come on and talk about this. I think it's a huge issue for every city out there because, you know, when Seattle starts doing it, a lot of other cities start copying it, and we appreciate your time today.
Thanks, Lars. I appreciate the call.
My pleasure. That's Seattle architect Marty Kaplan, and I know this is going on in other cities, big and small, not just around the Northwest, but around the country, and I don't appreciate it. I mean, I live in a nice house in a decent neighborhood. Mine's kind of a Heinz 57 neighborhood. There's all kinds of houses, big, small, cheap, expensive, everything else. And that's a good thing. But if you want to let the folks at City Hall in any city run by liberals say, we're going to have a plan for your neighborhood, and we don't have to care whether you like it or not, we're going to impose it on you. Like he said, we're voting for dictatorships. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you all over the Pacific Northwest, Oregon, Washington, and Idaho. Do you like the idea that city halls around this country are deciding that your neighborhood can be changed and you don't have anything to say about it? And then you've got Kate Brown, who announced yesterday to much fanfare and national publicity that she was going to keep the President of the United States from using the National Guard. Tom's on the line from Port Angeles, listening on KVI. How you doing, Tom?
I'm doing okay.
Okay.
I what's sure on your, could use what's a little good news today, but hey, that's another thing.
There is good news. We're going to have troops on the border. That's good news.
You bet. And what Kate Brown down there is doing is setting up the excuse for somewhere down the road that they won't have to pay for their costs of sending those troops down to the border.
Well, they wouldn't have to anyway if the president calls them up. They are federalized, and at that point, the federal government is paying the cost. And isn't it well worth it if we can stop illegal entry to the country and maybe some drugs at the same time?
Well, I'm just trying to let you know that some of us are thinking ahead and going, you know, that's what any good conspiracy would do, was keep people alert to things that they can do to gum up the system so that they don't have to fulfill their obligations.
Thanks
for what you do, Lars. I got to get around the corner.
Thanks very much, and I appreciate the call. Let's go to Medford and talk to Chris. Hey, Chris, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Well, it's Conspiracy Theory Thursday, so I thought I've been stewing on this for a little bit. I really feel like when the election took place and a whole bunch of people jumped over to the left and felt like they couldn't compromise or say anything good about conservative views or even moderate views, you had to be on the left or you were, you know, a horrible human being. Now we're kind of going into stage two, where it's not just being on the left is not good enough, because there's a lot of moderate Democrats that are for protecting our borders, that are not for paying for, you know, transgender operations with our military members. But no, you can't say that anymore. If you want any kind of freedom to, you know, to keep our Second Amendment rights in place, well, then you're a baby killer. And if you are wanting to protect our borders and keep the bad guys out, then you're a racist. And it just seems you've gotten so extreme that you can't even be a moderate Democrat anymore. I'm full-on conservative, so that's not necessarily my position, but I do know a lot of people that have more moderate views, but you're not even allowed to say that anymore.
Nope.
It comes from you've got to be friendly to the LGBT community, to encouraging our little boys to wear makeup and put on nail polish, because you can't give them any kind of gender identity. So you're breaking them before they even have a chance to grow up and mature and know what they want to do with their life.
I couldn't agree with you more. And Chris, we've been warning folks about this forever. I told you, when you go to the Republican convention, they do not define their delegations based on race, gender, or anything else. When you go to the Democrat convention, your delegation will not even be seated to help choose the next presidential nominee for that party unless it is exactly along the lines of what they say it will be. And I've seen those rules myself. They'll say to you, you have too many women. You have not enough women. You have too many men. You have too many people of color. You don't have enough of this category, that category. That kind of group is not going to be very tolerant of you stepping outside the lines. Let's go to Scott. Hey, Scott, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind?
Hi. Good afternoon, Lars. I had sent you an email. It was entitled, it has to do with Initiative 43, how we can impede progress and also make sure that the proposed ballot measure, as written by the state attorney general, it accurately reflects the measure.
Good luck.
Well, but what it does is, by filing these appeals that any voter can file, it impedes the progress of the initiative because it has to go through a hearing process. That's important because they have a very short time frame in order to get this ballot qualified for the measure.
It's July, isn't it? They have to have 100,000 or so signatures to qualify because it's 88,000, but you need more than that to actually qualify. And don't they have to have that by about the first week of July?
Yes, but what's more important, there's six steps, and I won't go through all of them, that they have to go through. And right now, by law, through the steps, right now they're going through and validating the sponsorship signatures. Then it goes to the state attorney general who writes the proposal. Here's the key point. After that, there's a 10-day period that a voter in Oregon can file a ballot title appeal. And that's available at sos.oregon.gov/elections.
Yeah.
It'll bring you to the elections page. On the right side is subscribe to the email updates. When the attorney general will use, emotionally charged words, which is against Oregon case law, we get to file an appeal against that. I've written mine up at the moment. What that means is right now, if no appeals are done, they can't collect signatures until May 17th.
That's a very good point. And then that gives them very little time before the first week of July. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails almost every week. As I watch the news from around the country and around the Northwest, I see another story about another educator who has gone out and committed sexual crimes against another student, sometimes more than one student. And I always wonder, is anybody doing anything about this? We have laws on the books that say that if a teacher and many other mandatory reporters, as they're described, knows about or even suspects that something is being done with a child that is not legal and is not moral or ethical or anything else, that you have to report that to the police, to the proper state authorities. And yet we're always hearing, as we've heard this week, about more of these. And sometimes they are incidents and crimes that were committed against children as much as a decade ago. I've asked Shasta Kearns-Moore to join me. She's a reporter for the Portland Tribune. Shasta, welcome to the program. And tell us about what was going on at St. Mary's Academy that has finally surfaced after about a decade.
Yeah. Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I first came onto this story in late January when the Teacher Standards and Practices Commission signed a final order revoking the license of Francesca Cronin, a St. Mary's English department teacher. She had resigned from the school last June after being put on leave in January of last year. And I started asking around about why she had been put on leave and why her license had been revoked. and eventually got in touch with Ariana Grande, who eventually decided that she would be named and go public with her story of a two-year-long sexual relationship with this teacher.
Well, as a reporter, you're to be congratulated for being able to find the victim, because ordinarily they hide that information pretty well, and to some extent it protects the privacy of people who may not want to be known, but it also makes them extraordinarily hard to find as a reporter, even if they do want to tell their story at some point. How did you talk her into that?
I talked to a lot of St. Mary's alumna. This is an all-girls Catholic school in downtown Portland, and it seems that the relationship between Ariana and Francesca was unusual to a lot of people. And so when this order came out, there were a couple of people who said, well, that's got to be this girl, because they had kind of a weird relationship.
Do you think, in that case, I don't have the language of the mandatory reporting law right in front of me, but my recollection of it is that it says that if anybody even suspects that a child is being abused, in other words, you don't have to have a certainty in your mind that a child's being abused before you're required to report it. So for all these people who said, yeah, that was a strange relationship, did you ask them, did it occur to any of them that this might have been a teacher violating the law and in some way that required them to report it?
Well, the people that I was talking to were classmates of hers. So mm-hmm. they were fellow students and are all sort of in their mid-20s now. And it's now, you know, after years of hindsight and an adult perspective that they realize, oh, this is actually really messed up.
Yeah, it is.
And so the teachers who had heard about it, in particular, the current principal, Nicole Foran, when she initially heard the rumors back in 2013, I believe she discounted them. She didn't believe them. And so there's kind of a gray area in the mandatory reporting law, which is that you need to have reasonable cause to believe that these rumors are true. And so that kind of different districts and different schools interpret that in different ways. My colleague Nick Budnick did a good piece on kind of the different ways that Portland Public Schools or Salem Kaiser Schools would approach that question. And there's kind of different answers there.
Well, I kind of wondered about this because it sounded as though we don't know for a fact whether Cronin ever committed a crime. She has not been accused of a crime, and I might point that out as well. But am I correct? We are now well past the statute of limitations, so no criminal accusation can ever even be made about the things that were alleged to have happened back then?
No, that's not true. That Ariana Gray is still within the statute of limitations, which I believe would be her 30th birthday, and she's almost 25 now. The reason that she decided not to go forward with criminal charges back a year ago when she was in discussions with the Portland Police Bureau was that she didn't want this to drag on any longer, and she doesn't ever want to see Francesca Cronin again. So
I can certainly understand that.
Yeah, so she could still, decide to press charges.
But it makes a lot of us wonder, and I've wondered over the years, how it is that this happens so frequently. As I said when I introduced you, there isn't a week goes by I don't see one of these cases from somewhere around America. So when people joke about the Catholic Church and its priests and the things that they went through, I'm not Catholic, but I looked at that, and there were plenty of people who would tell you, well, this is evil that this major institution allowed this to go on so long. American education it's still going on in American education, and it seems to pop up 40 or 50 times a year somewhere in America, maybe more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I talked with a sexual assault expert, Suzanne Moen, for this story, and she told me a lot of interesting things about teacher-student predations and how common they are, but also how many offenders, something in the 70-80% range, are serial in nature. They can have hundreds of victims over a lifetime. So a lot of a small number of people can be perpetrating a lot of crime.
Well, so in this case, do we have any great confidence that what's alleged to have happened between Francesca Cronin and Ms. Garay stopped after her encounters with this teacher? That it didn't go on other stuff.
I do know that that the reason that this all came to light was because one of the former classmates was worried about other students at the school that she had come to know, and that she was realized that this teacher was still teaching there. Now, it is important to note that the teacher and her husband are very vehemently denying these claims. They say that this is an elaborate fantasy of Ariana Gray's, and that it's been accusations that they've been fighting for many years.
And you can imagine if she truly was falsely accused, that would be a terrible thing to be accused of, even in this way. But apparently the Teacher Standards and Practices Board decided this was serious enough that they had to forbid her from ever being a teacher again?
True, yep.
And is she able to get licensed in other states with that mark?
I'm not familiar with that. I know that public records show that she started a business related to writing and editing. So I think that, and according to her husband's statement, she's sort of done with teaching.
Yeah, which I guess wouldn't be the worst thing in the world if it's true that it happened. And it would be a terrible tragedy, I guess, if somebody was driven out of a profession if they were falsely accused. But we'll never know one way or the other, will we?
Yes. Well, our investigation lasted about 2 months, and during that time, I was in constant contact with the Cronins, and I asked repeatedly for documentation or witnesses to substantiate some of their claims, and never really got anywhere with that other than having threatening legal letters levied against me. So, I think that I'm still open to hearing more of their side of the story. But at this point, there's quite a lot of evidence in Ariana's court.
Well, I'm not your editor, but you know what I've always wanted to know, Shasta? And I've got two radio shows a day. I don't have time to do the research of the public records. But how often does anyone in one of those mandatory reporter classes of people, teachers, doctors, nurses, social workers, there's a huge list of people who are expected to report when they're aware of something or, as you say, reasonable suspicion. How often does anybody ever get punished under that law? Because I've never heard of anybody being charged with failure to report. But the law is there, and it is a crime to fail to report. Does it never get prosecuted?
Yeah, I really have no idea about that. I don't know if there's if there even is any consequences. I didn't look into that.
Very good. Shasta, thanks for coming on to talk about the story.
Great. Thank you.
You bet. Shasta Kearns-Moore, who's a reporter for the Portland Tribune. Back in just a moment. Do you think that if you have a law on the books and you hear about cases like this time after time after time, we've heard about plenty of them in the Northwest just in the last few months, if it's not being reported promptly by the people in a position to know or suspect that it's going on, do you think there's a reason that people never get prosecuted for that crime, even though it seems it might be happening quite a bit? You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Pleasure to be with you. I'm going to check some of the reporting tonight on television and on the internet and find out how many reporters out there are actually going to point out that Kate Brown has no authority to block the President of the United States from calling up the National Guard from anywhere in America to go down on the border, although that's exactly what she says she will do. She will forbid him to use, in her case, the Oregon National Guard. Hey, Kate, if you're going to claim that you have control over the Oregon National Guard when they've been federalized, why not claim that you control the Idaho National Guard and the Washington National Guard and even the California National Guard? You don't actually have authority over them either, but you don't have authority to stop the president in this case. So if you're going to make a claim that's false, then why not make it broadly? On the Twitter poll today, should the governor have threatened to withhold National Guard troops from the border? Today's Twitter poll brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for your business, keep your biggest assets on the road and running right. Online at ultimatetruckservice.com. In yesterday's Twitter poll, I said, should we encourage people to vote who have no interest in voting? This is a more split response than we usually get. 64% of you join me in saying, no, don't encourage people who have absolutely no interest in voting. 36% of you said, yes, we should encourage people to vote who have no interest in voting. Oh, and by the way, Steve Novick, the liberal, and I are going to do our left hook, right jab tonight on Channel 8. That's KGW television in the 6 o'clock news hour. And let's go to naysayer Chris. Chris, we love the naysayers. What's on your mind and where do you and I disagree?
Yeah, hey, Lars. Well, I have a conspiracy theory. It's Conspiracy Theory Thursday.
Darn.
And I think it's not more, I think it's not a theory in as much as I can, I mean, it seems like the Republican Party is pretty open about it, and that's Interstate Crosscheck. Are you familiar with this program and Chris
no.
Kobach?
What is Interstate Crosscheck?
Essentially, what you have a cohort of like 14 secretaries of state, all Republicans, that are comparing voter rolls. And if last names match up with, say, for example, if there's a Juan Gonzalez in Oregon, then they'll get the voter rolls from a Juan Gonzalez in Colorado. They send Juan Gonzalez a postcard in the mail saying that you verify that you are who you are and you're not voting for two states. If you don't go in and return that postcard, then you're purged from the rolls. And
well, hold up. So that's the decision of that state to purge from the rolls, because this is a cooperative effort. I just got a little information in front of me on it. It was initiated in December of 2005 at the Midwest Election Officials Conference. So it wasn't a conspiracy of Republicans, by the office of the Kansas Secretary of State, Chris Kobach. And all they're saying is they combined the voter rolls and they didn't just compare name. They compared first name, last name, and full date of birth. So, my name is Lars Larson. There are a bunch of Lars Larsons, more so in Minnesota than, say, here in the Northwest, but there are half a dozen of them in the Portland area. There's probably a couple of dozen of them. There's a lot of Swedes up in Seattle, so I imagine there's some Lars Larsons there. But how often do you think you're going to find a Lars Larson spelled the way my first and last name are spelled, O-N, the way God is intended, on the last name, and the same date of birth?
That's kind of my point, Lars, is that white people aren't really affected by this. How many
white people aren't affected? What do you mean?
Well, there are ethnic names tend to be a lot more, like I said, Juan Gonzalez, Lee. These are very common ethnic names.
Well, Patel is a very common name, but hold on. In the United States, how many John Smiths do you suppose there are in the United States of America? How about, Joe Larson? I'll bet if there's a bunch of Lars Larsons, there have got to be dozens of Joe Larsons or Fred Larson. So when you say it doesn't affect white people, help me understand the logic. Especially if you assume that since people of color are about 30% of the population and white people, Caucasian people, are about 70%, since there are fewer people of color, and then you break up into different ethnicities, whether you're black, whether you're Native American, whether you're Hispanic, and then that becomes an even smaller percentage of people. You know, there may be a few Juan Gonzalez's, but there are English or Anglo names that are just as common, and there are a whole lot more of them in the United States, right?
Yeah, you're right. But even if I concede your point on that, this is going after a problem and investing millions of dollars in databases for a problem that's non-existent, Lars.
Well, hold on a second. When they analyzed, and here's some real data, when they analyzed first name, last name, date of birth, and did the cross-check, under Secretary Chris Kobach, the program expanded to 13 states to 29 states in 2014. And those states, those states made the decision to join this effort. So if a state under whoever's the Secretary of State at the time decides to join in this effort, they should have the right to do it. They cross-analyzed 98 million voter reg records. And they found 7.2 million potential duplicate registrant records. You don't think that's something worth spending a few dollars to find out?
Why would someone vote in two states, Lars? I understand.
Oh, my God. Chris, how old are you?
20. You know me, Lars. This is Liberal Chris, 28.
Okay, Liberal Chris. So here's the thing. Do you know that in Washington State, Chris Gregoire was elected governor, and the difference, she originally lost on the first two counts, but with the Democrats' rule is keep counting till you get the result you want, and they got the result on the third count. The difference was, I think it was 266 votes. Now, since there are people who live in the Portland Metro who are liberal Democrats, and Vancouver is right across the river, do you think a few hundred people might have had an incentive to vote across the river if they thought they could get away with it, if they thought they might actually decide the outcome of a gubernatorial election?
No, facing 5 years in prison? Who's dumb enough to do that?
Chris, do you know, I watch for cases where they actually prosecute people. They just had one in Texas, and Texas is one of the most populous states in the country. I mean, California and New York are more, but Texas has a huge population. When was the last time you can remember seeing a news story where someone in Oregon or Washington or Idaho was prosecuted for false registration or voting illegally?
Never.
Exactly.
They're unicorns, Lars.
No, but hold on. You're following, Chris, I know, look, you're a young guy, but do you know that way back when AIDS first came on the scene, do you know how many AIDS cases they had in Russia? Yeah. They had zero because Russia said AIDS is primarily a disease of gay people, and we have no gay people in Russia because being gay in Russia is illegal. So therefore, and Iran said the very same thing. It's the same logic you're using, or lack of. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I started out today and a bit of yesterday by pointing out to you that there is a really bizarre story about the way that computers have taken over our lives. You see, I think if you ask most people and say, hey, do you think we'll ever get to the point where people will, especially people in levels of high responsibility, will ignore their own common sense and simply do whatever a computer tells them to do? There have been plenty of movies where computers try to take over the world. The Terminator movies, of course, 2001 A Space Odyssey, released 50 years ago this week, and others that we could name, where a computer tells people to do things, and no matter how crazy or murderous or violent or dangerous it is, those in charge just salute the computer and say, you bet, I'll go do that because the computer told me to do it. Well, it's apparently happening at the Multnomah County Sheriff's Office, and former Sheriff Bernie Giusto joins me now. Bernie, welcome back to the program. How are you?
Good, Lars. Thanks.
I got to ask you about this because, and I'll give credit to Katie Shepard, who broke this story at Willamette Week. And so far, I haven't seen anybody but Katie and Willamette Week and this program talk about the fact that the sheriff's office is now following orders from a computer that says, release rapists, release this murderer. And they've said, we have no choice but to do it because the county commissioners said we had to do whatever the computer told us to do. Is that the way it would have worked when you were sheriff?
No, it's not, and that's incorrect. And it's another excuse for short-selling the public's safety. Let me explain to what we're talking about is this matrix system. It's a point system against the number of beds that the county commissioners fund. So let's not confuse ourselves in any jurisdiction that when commissioners, city councilors will not fund even reasonably adequate beds, then that matrix system become extremely dangerous because the number of people you're holding are less, and you think that's good. Well, it's bad because the fact is that those people become more increasingly dangerous and that population gets more increasingly dangerous. And so in a system, let's just take a system, any system that has 2,500 beds in it and only funding 1,200 or 1,192 beds, you put that matrix up against a no-win situation. And let me just dispel the myth. That resolution is no more than a resolution. The sheriff still controls that facility and that matrix. In that situation where we have a situation where a dangerous person is going to be released and you have a deputy sheriff's association telling you that you're releasing these people that are very dangerous, it's time for the sheriff to weigh in. Change that matrix, said this guy's not going, this guy's not going, this guy's going. Be challenged if he's going to get challenged, and not do that just erratically and just in a disproportionate fashion, but to step in, that's why he's there, and that's why any sheriff is there, is to step into those situations and provide the elected leadership, not the appointed leadership. He doesn't work for the county commissioners. All he does is responsible to them for the budget.
Except that, Bernie, the story that Katie Shepard reports says in it that the county commissioners have ordered the sheriff, and the sheriff's deputies apparently have said, we don't have any choice but to do what they've told us to do. Now, Reese, the current sheriff, is out of town on vacation, uh-huh. And I'm anxious to talk to him when he gets back, but they're using the, because you would think they'd say, we'll do whatever the computer says unless it doesn't make sense. They're not saying that. They're saying, we don't find that we have a lot of outs from doing exactly what the computer tells us to do. And to me, that sounds crazy.
Well, that's, if you read carefully, and you read it with an experienced ear, and I hope somebody would consider my ear experienced after running those jails for 6 to 7 years. The fact of the matter is what the deputies are saying, they individually have no authority to overrule what the computer tells them. They can't do it. The sheriff can do whatever the sheriff wants to do relative to being able to explain why he did it. That, again, is a situation where you have to, in context of what is being reported, it's not inaccurate. It's just there's no depth.
Well, let me read you a quote, though, Bernie. You know I don't like to disagree with you, but Matt Ingram, who's a board member of the Multnomah County Deputies Association, said, says, there's no way to override the lists. We're letting out people charged with sexual abuse and attempted murder, really atrocious crimes. So he's saying they are doing what the computer tells them to do, right?
Yes. Okay. Now, there we go. Again, now, so we're going to have a discussion about whether the computer rules or the sheriff rules. So what Matt's actually saying, and I know Matt because he worked with me at the sheriff's office, and this is not about Matt at all. What he's saying is that Matt Ingram cannot override what that computer says and is going to follow that, because if he doesn't follow it, he's going to lose his job.
Well, and she also says in the story, in fact, when the name of the accused killer, the one they started the story with, this guy, 18 years old, accused of murder, was at the top of the list for release. The sheriff did not overrule the computer. Instead, he asked the county chairwoman, Deborah Cafori, to temporarily open up a closed part of the jail so that he could use that space and not release this guy. But in this case, why would the sheriff then act as though he's constrained by that list instead of just saying, no, I'm not going to do that? And I don't need you to open any more space. I'm just not going to release this guy. He didn't overrule the computer.
I don't want to get in a debate with the current sheriff about this, right, Lars. But you can see that there was. Did you know that the beds had gone down 10%?
No, I know. I pointed it out in the commentary I did this morning. I said they decided to close a bunch of jail dormitories last year, ostensibly to save money, although it cost the community tremendously. And since then, I think it's 163 inmates, some of them dangerous and some less so, who've been released from custody. So they're not, and the county commission is not looking at this saying, well, if we've had to release 150 accused criminals or criminals from custody, because you have both, you have sentenced people and you have people awaiting trial, they're not moving to open up more space, even though they have the space available.
That's correct. This is a funding question and a funding question alone. I'm sure that the Deputy Sheriff's Association, the Crusher Deputy Sheriff's Association, is for sure had it with letting people go that are sex offenders that have committed assaults. And again, as I think Matt said in that article, these aren't people who broke into your car today. These are people who've committed person crimes, and maybe repetitively so. Yes, the matrix needs to be redone, but in the short term, the sheriff has got to exercise the muscle the elected authority gives him to do that. That's why he's elected and not appointed. Because when they ask voters, do you want us to have the county commissioners appoint your sheriff, what did they say? No way.
Yeah.
No way.
Well, and by the way, one of the things that troubles me about this is I know even among the public and among reporters, there's this sense that, yeah, if you're accused of rape or murder or assault, you should be kept in. Those are serious crimes. Then they say, but car theft is not. Well, this city is now ahead of Detroit in terms of car theft. The car thefts have skyrocketed. And why? Because they don't do anything about the car thieves. And, of course, I noticed that on the list of those who can be released for diversion or release into the county are car thieves. Now, I understand, Bernie, to you and me and people who've got nice paychecks, your car gets stolen, you call your insurance agent, you say, I need another car, and they take care of it. You call a rental company and you rent a car, or you call an Uber. But for an awful lot of people out there, and older cars tend to be stolen more because they're easier to break into and easier to wire, when the guy or gal loses his $5,000 transportation car, and maybe he isn't even covered for theft because he couldn't afford that either, he's losing his transportation. It's not assault in the form of hitting the guy upside the head with a 2x4, but it's assault in the sense that it's telling some man or woman, you aren't going to be able to get to work, get to pick up your kids, pick up the groceries, and all the other things. So, you know, I'm not sure. For an awful lot of people, would you rather take a punch in the face or lose your transportation? It might be a close match for some people.
Well, recently, you and I talked about the 12% increase in burglary across the county. And I'm telling you, this is exactly the result of Matrix, is that there's no fear for anybody breaking into your home. And if you don't think burglary is as bad as any other crime relative to how you feel about your safety and privacy, you're wrong. And it often happens in the poorest of communities that have no other answer, whether it be car theft or burglary or securing their homes, and they just continue to be victimized time and time again. This is simply a question about priorities. There's nothing wrong with taking a look at the justice system and redoing it logically, but not at the expense of the safety of everyday citizens who are just trying to live their lives safely in their community. And the worst communities for being victimized are the communities that oftentimes are the ones that are experiencing the biggest increase in crimes.
Yeah, and there's the other problem that when we talk about nonviolent crimes, I'm sure that an awful lot of people in the Northwest include drug crimes in that. And they say, well, they're nonviolent. Really? The guy selling heroin, he's a nonviolent guy. Can you explain the more than 1,000 Americans who die every week, 60,000 a year from heroin overdoses? And then explain to me how selling heroin is a nonviolent crime.
And that same rationale applies to the gang problem. Gangsters aren't gangsters because they are out here like West Side Story. They're here because they're burglars, they're thieves, they move drugs, and they assault, and they rob. So if you don't think those are all connected under the word gangster, it certainly is.
No, it absolutely is. Bernie, thanks a lot for sharing your insights and your expertise. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Lars.
Back in just a moment. You're listening to The Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to The Lars Larson Show. Well, you heard 2 days ago the President of the United States announced he would put troops on the American border on our south, and he would keep illegal aliens from coming in because the Congress will not fund a wall. And then we heard yesterday that it was going to be the National Guard, but that Kate Brown, governor of Oregon, was going to forbid the president to use the National Guard. Kate apparently not understanding that the laws and the rules do not allow her to do that because she commands the National Guard until and unless the president federalizes them. And at that point, Kate Brown loses her National Guard command authority. It goes away. But at least a few of you have imagined this. Kate Brown, channeling George Wallace from Alabama, standing on the steps of the armory where the National Guard is stationed and saying that she will not let those troops go out of the armory and go down to guard America's southern border. That's right, Kate. Just keep doing that. It worked out so well for Wallace. Maybe it'll work out for you. Let's go to Josh in Salem. Hey, Josh, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. How are you?
Good. How are you, Lars?
Not so bad. What's on your mind?
So about the whole Kate Brown and the National Guard thing, I don't know. I'm sure you know quite a few servicemen, soldiers, and whatnot.
I do.
I know quite a few as well, both current and retired. The one thing that I've noticed about quite a few of them is that they're pretty conservative bunch.
Yeah, they are.
You know, they pretty well love the Second Amendment. They love serving their country. And so I find it kind of interesting that Kate Brown, you know, once the National or the Oregon Guard has been federalized, thinks that, well, not only is she going to have to submit to the federal authority, but that that they would even consider standing behind her when they're probably a majority of them anyhow would be Trump supporters and Republicans and whatnot anyways.
Well, let me throw something into that discussion. I do know a lot of former military. I'm not, but I know a lot of vets. I know a lot of currently active duty service members. And the thing is, it doesn't matter what they say or think in that case, because they may agree with Governor Kate Brown, but while she is their commander, while they're still at the state level, they have to do what they're told to do. The governor could call up the commander of the National Guard, who we've asked for an interview with, but apparently does not want to come on and talk about this. She could tell him, you're going to Eastern Oregon to fight fires. And you know what the military does? They salute and say, yes, ma'am, and they go and do it. If the president says, I'm sending military units to the border, his commanders, they may give him some feedback and say, Mr. President, we could do it better if we did it this way. But other than that, they salute and they say, yes, sir. So, you know, no matter what the individual service members think or feel, one of the things they've done when they put on that uniform is they've told us, whatever our commanders tell us to do, we're going to do, as long as it's a lawful order. But Kate Brown seems to think that she retains control of the National Guard as though they belong to her, that they're her property, and that when the president calls them up, that she can somehow stand in the way and say, I'm not going to let it happen. And it suggests to me that either she knows the real rules and is just, you know, lying. That's one possibility. She could say, I'm going to go out and tell people I'm not going to let it happen, even though I don't have the power to do that. Or it suggests that she doesn't know what she's talking about and has no idea that once they federalize those National Guard members, she has no control over them. So, and I've called the governor's office. We've called the National Guard and asked for their commander to come on and talk about this. Now, I'm sure that the National Guard commander is not anxious to come on and contradict the governor on the radio, but he should be willing to do that. I think he should come on and say, well, the governor says she controls us, even if the president calls us up, and she's incorrect about that. He could say that much. But we've invited him, and so far he hasn't said yes.
Right, and that was my point, is that if the president calls them up and they become federalized, that she actually thinks that she's going to be able to hold them back from going and serving their country.
That's absolutely right. Josh, thanks for the call. Let's go to Mike. Hey, Mike, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars. Just a call or so before talking about the opiate issue.
Yeah.
And the opiate problem that we have in our country, and we have a lot of people dying, unfortunately, because of this issue.
We do, yep.
And the other side of the issue is people like myself. I go to a pain management clinic here in Medford, Oregon. They take very good care of me. And I, unfortunately, have to take opiates. I have to take oxycodone just to be able to walk around every day.
Mike, I want to give you fair warning. We're 30 seconds from the break, so I need you to get to your point, as the producers asked you to.
My point is that there's so much bad news and so much being done to people like myself. I have friends that were in pain management, that are out of pain management because of the way the system is, that are now having to use heroin for their pain management.
Nothing forces you to go out and break the law and buy illegal drugs. No. And let me mention that most of the people who die because they started on street drugs and they died on street drugs. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your phone calls and emails. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network throughout Oregon, Washington, and Idaho, and glad always to talk about the issues of the Pacific Northwest. Our Twitter poll today, should the governor have threatened to withhold National Guard troops from the border, even if the president calls them up? I pointed out that while you're not going to read this or see this very many places, Governor Kate Brown does not have that authority. In fact, as far as I can tell, the governor of Washington State has not announced that he's going to try and, you know, stand in the schoolhouse door and keep the National Guard from going down to the border if the president calls them up. Maybe Jay Inslee is just a little bit smarter than Kate Brown, but I'm going to ask you the question anyway. Should the governor have threatened to withhold the National Guard troops even when she has no authority to do so? The Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show on Twitter, LarsLarson.com on the web, and it's brought to you by Ultimate Truck Service. If you rely on trucks for your business, keep the biggest assets on the road and running right online at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, in Spokane, they are doing something about housing. Boy, housing is tight everywhere in the Northwest. There are very, very few small cities that have not been hit by the housing crunch. Seattle's been hit, Eugene's been hit, Spokane's been hit, the Tri-Cities. Everywhere rent is going through the roof. There is not nearly enough housing, and they say they need thousands and thousands of additional units. And, of course, the primary thing that stands in the way is government rules and regulations. You know, Texas does not seem to have this problem. Idaho, to a large extent, does not have this problem. But then again, they don't have some of the cockamamie rules that we have here. Well, here we have, out of the Spokesman Review, expansion of low-income housing program to help build more homes in Spokane. And you think, I wonder what they're doing. And that's why I looked at the story. I thought, I wonder what big, innovative thing they're doing to build more housing in the city of Spokane. Because you see, in Portland, they're running programs where it costs twice as much, $200,000 a unit, to build housing as the private sector can build it for, but that's why you get the government involved, so it can cost twice as much. Because when it costs twice as much, you can only build half as much. But in Spokane, I thought, well, maybe they've got something a little bit better. Yeah, here's what's happening. Maria Cantwell, Democrat senator from Washington State, held a press conference to announce that she was going to expand this program. Is it a brand new program? No, it's actually been around for 32 years, a third of a century. And in those 32 years, what has this program done? It has created 1,000 housing units. In other words, about 2 housing units a month, 30 housing units a year. And these projects are relatively small. So what are they going to do? They're going to have some projects in Redmond, Royal City. They've got a number of them, Airway Heights in Spokane. But the program is just a tax credit program. So it's a little bit of help, but not nearly as much help as you'd get if City Hall got off the backs of developers and if some of the ridiculous requirements that are in place on people who are trying to, build some housing, if you got out of the way, you might be able to actually do something about this problem. But unfortunately, they haven't been able to do it. You want to jump into the best conversation in talk journalism? It's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. And later this hour, we're going to talk to my old buddy Dennis Miller. We were actually syndicated by the same company for a while, but he is about 1,000 times more funny than I am. And he's very popular, and he's very conservative as well. We'll talk to Dennis Miller a little bit later on this hour, and we'll get your calls on as well. Again, 866-439-5277. Wes is on the line. Hey, Wes, welcome to the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Hey, I have a question for you, sir.
Sure.
If the governor, Kate Brown, deliberately disobeys a federal order when it comes to President Trump instituting the National Guard, can she get arrested for that?
No. And here's the thing. She won't be ordered to call up the Guard. The president calls up the Guard. He sends the message down through the chain and says, I need some Guard units. And if you look at the law, he's allowed to call up the National Guard. Until they're called up by the president, they are under the control of the governor. So Idaho's National Guard is under the control of the governor of Idaho, et cetera. But when the president calls them up, he can call them up a number of different ways. The most direct way is the presidential reserve call-up. When the president determines that it's necessary to augment the active forces or for any operational mission for any unit or any member, not for more than 270 days, about 9 months. So when he calls them up, it's federalized. Federalized National Guard forces have been ordered by the president to active duty either in reserve component or by calling them into their federal service in the militia status. And there are a bunch of different ways he could do that. But, he can do it for a number of reasons, to, take care of an insurrection. You can do a number of things with them, not including law enforcement. But he can guard a border. He can call up the Guard to guard a border, and I think the president knows what he's talking about, and Kate Brown doesn't. He doesn't need her cooperation at all. She may get a courtesy call from the White House saying, by the way, we're calling up your National Guard. We're going to need this many people, but it's a courtesy call. He doesn't have to order them. He orders the military commanders of the Guard.
Cool. Well, that sounds good. Thanks for your answer.
I know there might have been some disappointment there that we couldn't throw Kate Brown in jail. But, hey, at least we know that she doesn't know what she's talking about. Let's go to Dan in Olympia. Hey, Dan, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Lars, thanks for taking my phone call.
You bet.
I do not have a conspiracy theory, but I do have a story of a recent really, really bad experience that we had on a cruise.
All right. What happened?
And it's actually just hit the front page of Fox News this morning, and it's been on Newsweek, actually. So I'm sure people are hearing about it. We had basically a floating construction site on a recent Panama Canal cruise. Left Miami on March 16th, arrived in L.A. on the 31st, and basically 2 days after we left, it became like a floating dry dock.
They were refurbing the boat while you were on board it?
Majorly, not just a little. I mean, when we first got on there, standing in our muster stations, doing our lifeboat drill, and there were just pallets and pallets full of these 5 gallon buckets of floor stripper and sanding primer and all kinds of just chemicals and things. And so we assumed they were taking it up to Victoria. They were doing a dry dock for 2.5 weeks in Victoria, which is up there now. And then they're going to be in Seattle on April 19th to pick up passengers to go back around to Orlando. So, yeah, and we just experienced terrible stuff. I mean, there's stuff blowing in our food, dust everywhere, chemical smell, you know.
Let me ask you about that, though, because my wife and I have taken several cruises. We've never done what they call a repositioning cruise, where they say, you know, you can actually get on one of these boats and you can go from the United States to Europe. You can go a number of places because they will run a boat or a ship in one area during certain times of the year for weather reasons. And then they'll move it to another area so they can keep it busy during, say, winter, you know, here. And they move them around for a bunch of reasons. But they usually give you a deal on that. And they would tell you ahead of time, it's a repositioning cruise. There aren't going to be very many people on board. I've had friends who've done that, and they've said, oh, it's a lot of fun because you're on a boat built for 3,000 people, and there's only 300 passengers, and it's terrific. Did they in any way, shape, or form, when you booked the cruise, say, by the way, this is going to be a cruise on which we're going to be doing construction on the boat and rehab on the boat while you're on board?
No, in fact, none of that. And it really wasn't a repositioning cruise. It was an actual, just a regular cruise. They were just doing it before dry dock, just for a short dry dock period. And then they're going back. So they've been actually cruising. But there was no notice given. There was nothing. The people on board, some of the staff, said that this decision was made from the head office at the headquarters in Miami.
Yeah.
Nobody knew about it. The captain, we confronted the captain. We got a bunch of passengers together, and we had a standing room only meeting. And, there was no notice given to anybody. And I think that's what made everybody so angry.
Have they offered to compensate you in any way?
Yeah, after we had the meeting, and I do have to say that did not go well. Captain stormed off, and people booed him, and it was bad. But I don't know what happened after that. But 2 days later, we all got a notice on our door that they were I don't know if an apology is the right word, but they were trying to compensate us 25% of the value of that current cruise on a future cruise. But they gave us literally a year to use it, so there's not a lot of time there, and a lot of people traveled from the UK and Australia and all over the place.
And they're not going to cover the cost of your airfare to get back to wherever the boat's going, right?
No, but they're just assuming, hey, we want you to take our cruise line again. And I don't have any problems so much with NCL, but lately they've been making some seriously bad choices. Last December or January, they had the breakaway where they, sailed it into the storm out in the Atlantic and had all the problems and stuff. So this is like kind of an ongoing bad decision, I think, that they're doing.
It sounds like it. It sounds like they're going to pay for it because people are going to become aware of it. And Dan, thank you very much. I appreciate the call. Back in just a moment. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network. Dennis Miller coming up a little bit later on this hour. We get a chance to talk to him, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Yeah. Look for the union label.
You know what I love? Paying union dues. Just so I can keep my job.
I'm sticking to the union.
I think it's great that my union dues are going to politicians I don't even like.
The union. I'm the
Thanks, union bosses.
Join the union tonight.
Another great American idea. Forced upon us by the government to take more of our money and give them control. They are the unions. Now, to expose them and break them to pieces, here's Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I thought I'd mention this. Burgerville is a great Northwest company. I have no financial ties there other than occasionally buying a sandwich there. And I'm willing to pay the premium price because they do charge a bit more than the regular chains, but they produce a quality product. Well, I have a feeling they're headed for some bad news because their workers, at least at one place, and it could spread to others, have decided to have a unionization vote. Now, I think if those workers are smart, they will vote not to be represented by a labor union. That's the decision that most of the folks in America have decided to do. 94% of American private sector workers have chosen not to be represented by a union. Only 6% chose to be represented, but they're going to do it at Burgerville. Imagine all the things that are crashing down on top of the fast food industry, and then you tell me what you think the likely result is. Number one, hugely higher minimum wages in the Pacific Northwest, both Oregon and Washington, for minimum wage workers. And a lot of Burgerville workers are at or near minimum wage. Number two, huge regulations. And those cost money for a business as well. And then put unionization on top of it. Why, I can't think of a better way to get to your bosses at Burgerville to try to automate your job out of existence than by doing these things. But somehow the International Workers of the World, the IWW, has persuaded some of these young people, men and women, and probably people who go by a pronoun, to vote in favor of unionization. Should be interesting to see how they vote on that. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails. By the way, tonight, my liberal friend or colleague, Steve Novick, and I are doing left hook, right jab on Channel 8 in the 6 o'clock news hour. And that's always fun. We're going to talk about taxes. And not the tax bill from, last Christmas time. We're going to talk about whether or not you trust the government to spend your money wisely. Of course, Steve believes that, because he's a former city council member, he believes that they will spend the money wisely. And I, of course, have seen too many examples where the government spends your money foolishly there are usually more pieces of evidence on my side of that argument. Let me go to John in Hood River. Hey, John. Wow, that's a noisy line. Let's see if we can get him on a quieter line before we talk to him. Let's go to Hank in Vancouver, B.C. Hank, welcome to the Lower 48. How are you?
Well, I'm doing great anytime I talk to you.
Thank you.
I have a T-shirt that says, President Trump, make B.C. part of the USA. Our government out of here, up here, is right out of whack. And I like your president because he says it the way it is. He's not diplomatic, but he's trying to put the Bible back in the justice system, back in the schools, and back in the homes. And that's how the United States and Canada was built. He exposes corruption down there like there is no tomorrow. And what size T-shirt can I send you, sir?
I would be happy to pay for a T-shirt, and you know, I'd be glad. I've gotten down to a large size instead of an XL. I used to be an XL, and now I'm happy to be a large, but that's what diabetes will do for you. Now, Hank, do you think you can actually persuade Donald Trump, with all the problems that we've been having with borders, to actually add some territory to the United States rather than try to just guard what we've already got?
Well, think of it this way. Our president or our premier is bringing in 200,000 Muslims into Canada in the next little while.
Good
luck. You have a problem with the Canadian. You've got a problem with the Canadian border, just the same as you have with the Mexican border.
I'd have to agree with you on that. And Hank, I'll look forward to buying that T-shirt. Thank you very much. Let's go to Barry. Hey, Barry, welcome to the Lars Larson Show. What's on your mind today?
Oh, okay. I was trying to get through yesterday, but you were busy. Anyway, you made a statement yesterday that you would be interested, and I would share in the same view as you. You'd like to hear on the news both sides of an argument instead of just one side.
I would.
I agree with you. Whatever happened to the Fair Reporting Act? Are you familiar with that?
Well, are you talking about the fair, not fair use standard, but it's, What you're talking about is there used to be a requirement done away with in 1986 under President Reagan that required...
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, and you know what? That was the death of both sides on radio. When we got rid of it, talk radio blossomed in America. It went from 100 stations to now, I think, close to 3,000 spoken word stations in the United States. And it wasn't because the number of stations got bigger. It was just there were a lot more stations that were willing to do talk radio who were not willing to do it under that act, because you'd go to the general manager and say, why don't you do an editorial? I actually did this one time and said, some station managers in the past have done editorials. And he said, no, because if I do an editorial, then if anybody walks in the door and says, hey, I'd like to do a response to that, we have to provide them with, you know, room and time, whether their, you know, their point of view is good programming or not. As soon as we got rid of it, we let the marketplace decide. Talk radio took off like crazy. It went from being one of the smallest formats in America to one of the largest. And as you hear, if you listen to this show, you hear liberals talk to me. I bring on liberal guests. I had one just 2 hours ago, an architect from Seattle. But we find the places where we agree, and we find the places where we disagree. And, of course, naysayers go first. So I don't want to have the Congress, and I don't even think it's constitutional for the Congress or the government to have rules or laws that determine what kind of point of view you have to put on the air. And I would say that even if you applied that to cable television and, you know, over-the-air television and radio, I do not want the government to define what they consider is fair, because their definition is likely to be fit to whatever the current political times are. I'd rather have the marketplace decide. If people want to hear talk radio, and clearly they do, we have a lot of talk radio in America. We did not before that doctrine was eliminated. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to take your phone calls and emails, but it's a real pleasure to welcome back an old friend to the program, one who is far more talented than I am, and one who is coming to the Pacific Northwest, Dennis Miller, the Emmy Award-winning stand-up comedian, talk show host, political commentator, and I might mention, since he lives down in Southern California, a real conservative who's going to be at the Fox Theater in Spokane this Friday. Then he'll be at the Morrison Center in Boise on Saturday and the Pantages Theater in Tacoma on Sunday. Dennis, you're keeping up that killer schedule still, aren't you?
Nice to talk to you, Lars. Been a while. Have to correct you. Socially liberal, fiscally, and as far as the war on terror, conservative, which is what has set the record straight. But as far as most people's personal day-to-day lives,
I'm not interested enough to care about their predilections. So it's done with a bit of insouciance. But nice to hear your voice again.
It's nice to hear your voice again as well. And I've always enjoyed visiting with you. For a time, we were with the same syndicator and all. But he stays a whole lot more busy than I do. But I didn't want to put you in a position where labeling you as a conservative would cause you any trouble with your neighbors down there.
It didn't cause me any trouble. I just like to be accurate. I'm like I said, I'd like to keep half my money, and I don't trust radical Islam as far as I can throw it. Outside of that, though, I'm just live and let live for the most part.
Absolutely. So you're finding a lot of material to work with these days with President Trump in office?
Well, listen, I can't. They've reached an odd point where I guess I'm construed to be a hater or a bad guy if I don't wake up every morning and see Donald Trump as Adolf Hitler. But I'm just being candid. I don't. When people say, Trump's like Hitler, I always think, well, I think what they mean by that. My go-to reference on Hitler is that he liquidated 6 million of his fellow human beings. So, when they look me straight in the face and say, Trump's like Hitler, I I don't know what to say anymore. I just sort of want to get out of there because if somebody's at that point, I just go, well, whatever you say, and I keep moving. There's a roadrunner cloud heading off into the distance. Listen, I know Trump's got rough edges, but let me say this. I think Trump's outer voice, warts and all, is an accurate depiction of his inner voice, whereas I don't think Hillary Clinton's inner voice and outer voice have ever even had a cup of coffee together. They could have passed out a big piece of paper in that last election that had two boxes on it, one that said Hillary and one that said not Hillary, and I was going to scrawl my ex in the not Hillary. I don't trust her. I think she's two-faced enough to open up a couple iPhone 10 simultaneously.
What do you think of the excuses she's been making lately for why she didn't win?
I guess it's empowering. The world's flipped upside down now, Lars. People talk about what an empowered woman she is. And I guess, like I said, I try not to fight with people. When somebody looks at me and you say, is that whining? And they say, no. I just say, all right, I'm not going to change your mind. She seems a little soft to me. I think she played a lot of these cards and it didn't pan out. I think she thought a lot of women whined as much as she does about this, and they don't. I think some women looked at her and the fact that she'd been cheated on more frequently than a blind woman playing Scrabble with gypsies and thought, why don't you kick that bum's ass out of the house? And so it didn't work for her, and she's not the president. And I guess once you reach your second or third year of explaining why it wasn't your fault, that's fine. Whatever she wants to do. But there are certain people it falls on a deaf ear. It seems a little screechy to me.
Yeah, it does. And, I guess I just wish she could take the loss with class. I mean, we like winners in America, but we also like losers who can lose with a little bit of class and say, okay, I offered you the choice, and I was never a fan of her, and I didn't like her policies, and I kind of didn't like her personally, and I especially didn't like the fact that women lauded her as a champion of women, as you say. She got treated like a doormat by her husband, and apparently she was willing to trade doormat for a future public office.
Well, all I can say is this. Because of the hashtag MeToo thing, every guy in this country, including, I read an article about a 16-year-old Fred Savage on the Wonder Years pinching his makeup artist, but everybody is under the microscope except one guy. Bill Clinton.
Yeah, Bill.
I think that tells you everything you need to know. He's the one who skates. He's the one who walks away. And therefore, when people say, well, all men, but except Bill Clinton, I always say, oh, my God, this is how flipped it is. What a cosmic wormhole we've fallen through. And Bill Clinton, and that marriage couldn't be any more about convenience if they installed a Slim Jim rack and a Slurpee machine at the base of their bed. Yet he's the one guy who walks away. Unbelievable.
It is. Have you heard the latest bunch to be targeted by the Me Too movement? It's the Munchkins and Judy Garland.
Well, no, I haven't read that, quite frankly. But I do notice that the only guy who skates is the guy, To put it this way, he and Ted Kennedy, although there's a film coming out now where it looks like they're going to be smirching him a little, it always makes me shake my head. Let's just say that the long trek for female rights from Chappaquiddick to Chappaqua was talked, but not walked.
Dennis Miller is going to be showing up at three shows in the Northwest this weekend, Fox Theater in Spokane, and we're on in Spokane, Morrison Center in Boise, and the Pantages in Tacoma. Let me ask you something. I'm a little frustrated because it seems as though the entire country is divided, but a lot of it is because some of the political activists have said, there's no way we're going along with anything this guy does. And I keep wondering, Is there going to be a watershed movement, say, in the first 4 years or perhaps in the second 4 years of Trump, because I think he's going to get reelected at this point, where folks are going to say, you know what, we didn't like him, but, yeah, it seems to be working out pretty good. Paycheck's bigger, economy's brighter, we're a little tougher with our enemies and a little better with our friends, and people are going to kind of sit down and have a, you know, have maybe a readjustment of their attitudes?
Not publicly. Listen, all I'd say is this. You can see the beauty of the secret ballot. Is it called the Australian ballot, I think? I don't know if that's quite where it was hatched, but it seems to make sense that you go into a place where it's private. I know people who, if they get a call from a pollster during an election year after dinner at home and they say, are you going to vote for Donald Trump? They would just say, I'd rather not talk or hang the phone up or stuff like that. You can put yourself in harm's way. It's like Jerry Seinfeld said, you really want to go on a college campus and perform for a college crowd now? You have one joke that they don't like and they throw a bike rack through a plate glass window? It's odd out there. I would just keep shaking my head, shuffling, and then moving along. And when it comes to the election time, go in the booth where you're alone. We'll see if Trump gets reelected or not. I don't think he's as down in the polls as they would like to believe. And the simple fact is I think this infrastructure project, he's reinforcing bridges because he knows there's a lot of people that are going to jump off him when he gets a second term.
Now, are the college kids loving you these days, Dennis?
No, but that's fine. I'm 64. Wow. You know, if I was making sense, the college kids in my mid-60s, I don't know, do you remember yourself in college? I would have hated me.
I just wonder about that because you give up a certain amount by having that piece of you that is not completely full-on left-wing, you know, L.A. Progressive, and you give some of it up professionally.
Oh, listen, Hollywood makes the mistake of always siding with the people who get comped to begin with, and they better start siding with the ticket buyers. They're always siding with the people who never pay hard cash on the barrel for a ticket, starting to catch up to them. There are a lot of people out there who differ from what they think, and that doesn't make them evil people. I always find it fascinating that progressives at this point in history all want to go to Havana, Cuba, but because of the bathroom thing down there, they won't connect through Charlotte, North Carolina. They're making a big mistake when they polarize half the country and say they're bad people because they merely disagree with them politically. It's too strident. Even Orwell would have said, nah, I think that's too on the head.
But, I mean, some of those beliefs of theirs must go really, really deep because, I mean, there's the rap on Hollywood that they'll put anything on the screen as long as it makes money. And you have to add to that as long as it doesn't, you know, violate the, you know, the liberal meme, because they've done some movies that conservatives absolutely loved. And every time they came out with one, I thought, hey, they finally figured it out. We'll see 10 more movies like this. And then they have to go out and do, you know, 10 more Valley of Elahs or Ewa or whatever it was. You know, movies that are America-hating movies. Movies that disparage America, disparage the military, disparage corporations. And you think, you have to do all these money losers? I thought you were in it to make money. And I think at some point you would imagine that they would get that straightened out.
All I know is, Lars, people come to Hollywood to be with the cool kids. It's the in crowd. And I don't think many people are willing to risk, even if they believe in it. I've talked to guys in Hollywood who have given me a wink, wink, nod, nod about them having some conservative leanings. And like I said, I'm socially liberal, but there are people out there who will just sit on it because it's the cost of doing business. It's a rough place now. You risk being polarized. I think Roseanne will help it a little because now they can see that they can strike a big gusher because there's a crowd that's not being tended to. But by and large, unless they're going to make an absolute killing, why do you want to rock the boat and not be RSVP'd to every hip party in the town by coming out and saying you have some conservative leanings? That's not why they came to Hollywood, to be a pariah.
No, and a lot of us who are conservative looked at the success of Roseanne and said, that's fantastic. What, 18 million the first night and then a whole bunch of reviews and, you know, later views. It was fantastic. Dennis Miller is a funny man. He's been a great friend of the program, and I'm glad to have him back on. Your shows are Spokane, Fox Theater this Friday, Boise, the Morrison Center on Saturday, and then Tacoma and the Pantages Theater on Sunday. Dennis, it is always a pleasure. I'm glad to see you doing so well.
Nice to talk to you, Lars. We'll see you down the road.
Take care now. That's Dennis Miller with us. We'll be back in just a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. We've been getting the details a bit by bit this week. Donald Trump had announced he was going to put the military on our southern border, and then came the details the next day that he was going to get the National Guard, so we know which units. And then we saw Kate Brown say that she was going to stop President Trump from doing that. Not that she has the slightest bit of authority to do that, which turned Kate Brown into a bit of a joke. Now we hear this afternoon, late today breaks the story, 2,000 to 4,000, that's the number of National Guard troops that Donald Trump says he wants to have on the Mexican border. He also says they will be there until the wall is built. And I would love to see this happen. By the way, before I go to David Cross, let me get Tom on the line. Tom, you have a suggestion about what you'd like to see when the president puts troops on our southern border?
Yep, he needs to pull all the National Guard units from the sanctuary states down there to help out.
I think that's a terrific idea. Maybe you could get National Guard units from Washington, Oregon, California. Yep. I have a feeling within those National Guard units are a whole bunch of people who really do want the border of their country guarded.
Right. And they need to bring down like the reconnaissance troops, like the cavalry units that are self-sustained, that specialize in reconnaissance surveillance. They can sit on the border and do their job.
I think it's a terrific idea. Tom, thanks a lot. I appreciate the call. Let's go to David Cross, who each and every week supplies us with a news story about some of the illegal alien happenings here in the Northwest. Hey, David, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
It's good to be back with you, Lars. The story that you broke this today on Kate Brown, the governor of Oregon, unwillingness to deploy troops to the Mexican border is really eating up everything in the country. But it just goes to show how much Kate Brown is disconnected from her own state. Lars, I just did, you know, the DOC report a couple weeks ago, and 776 of the criminal aliens in the Oregon Department of Correction prison system were Mexican nationals. The U.S. Attorney's Office, and I know you talked about this last week, 12 of the 22 individuals prosecuted by the U.S. Attorney for the District of Oregon, Billy Williams, who is a Democrat, I think, were Mexican nationals. They're a Mexican drug trafficking organization operating in Multnomah, Washington, Clackamas County. And then I just did the Federal Bureau of Prisons report, and it turns out that 20% of the federal prisoners in the Federal Bureau of Prisons are foreign nationals. 63% of those are Mexican nationals. It seems like Kate Brown is living in a cell-proof box. Lars, we've been invaded by criminals.
Yeah, we have been. And there seem, in fact, I noticed that today the president was, I believe, in West Virginia, and he was speaking, and CNN, like they're inclined to do, had said the president again makes the false claim that people come here who are illegal aliens and commit crimes. But you and I both know the numbers suggest that what he has been telling the American public is exactly right, that you and I have been talking about literally for years, that there is a disproportionate amount of crime, and especially some of the truly ugliest crimes that you've seen committed, murders and rapes and the like, that are committed by people who are in the country illegally. And it makes logical sense that if somebody is already breaking a bunch of laws by being here, they're not going to feel too constrained by all the other laws. You know, the young man who's here illegally, who's breaking half a dozen laws, and then they say, but you can't, you know, have a 14-year-old girlfriend when you're 25 because that's rape. Says, no, it's not. I don't care. I'm not held to the laws. And I think it's kind of frightening that there are folks who view these people as immigrants, because an immigrant comes to a new country, I hope, to fit in the new country and to obey the local laws and even the local customs. And yet, here's a crowd of people who, not all of them, but a disproportionate number of them, commit crimes, and they don't care whether it hurts other people.
When you get such a large percentage of prisoners in the system, that's overrepresentative of the system. And this information's publicly available to all Lars Larson's listeners. I post all this information, our transcripts, on DOCFNC, the blog you suggested I set up there in 2010. And all these numbers have hyperlinks where people can look this information up for themselves, including politicians, because you know that I go to these politicians most often with this information before we even talk about it on the air.
That's right. And you notice that just a couple of years ago during the tail end of the Obama administration was when a lot of the sheriff's department said, we're going to stop posting the information about immigration status on our jail website. Because it used to be possible to look somebody up and say, oh, he's on an ICE detainer, which means he is likely in the country illegally or he has violated the conditions of his green card. And there you go. David, thanks for the update, and I appreciate it. By the way, tomorrow, live from Northwest Armory for First Amendment Friday, I'll be glad to see you in person or talk to you on the phone. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show.